Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. January 18th, 2024, the Why Trump Won Iowa edition. I'm David Plotz of CityCast here in Washington, D.C., joined by John Dickerson of CBS Primetime from New York City. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
John and I saw each other briefly for reasons that we'll discuss later this week, which was great. And a little treat, Dickerson in the home. And from somewhere, I don't think she's at home, Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. I'm in Palo Alto, which is very nice and benign weather compared to my normal life. Also, I came through Chicago. So anyway,
do you have a startup that you're getting funded? Are you working?
Yeah.
Are you now doing AI? Are they taking all your thoughts and turning them into AI?
You've guessed it all. I brought.
Are you replacing Sheryl Sandberg on the Meta? Sandberg on the Meta board. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, all of the above.
This week on the Gabfest, Trump crushed DeSantis and Haley in Iowa. Why did he win so easily? Is there anything that can stop him winning the nomination? Then what is Chevron deference and what will happen to the federal government if, or perhaps when, the Supreme Court guts it? We'll talk about a really interesting Supreme Court case, Loper-Bright, that was argued this week. Then what if the SAT is actually good? We will talk to David Leonhardt of the New York Times about his fascinating piece arguing that the recent abandonment of the SAT and ACT has been bad for diversity and bad for higher education. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. To the dismay of many, the surprise of no one, former President Trump dominated the Iowa caucuses on Monday. He won more than 50% of caucus votes, although I can never tell if they're supposed to be called votes. I'm just going to call them votes. John can correct me in a minute.
What would you call them?
I don't know. Sandwiches? Maybe there's some term. I don't know.
Yes.
It's caucuses. And then they get really mad if you say plural caucuses when it's caucus.
No, other way around. It's caucuses. Oh.
Okay. If you say caucus, they get really mad.
Yeah. Caucuslets.
He defeated Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy, who dropped out. DeSantis and Haley limped in around 20% each. It confirmed what we already knew, which is that the majority of Republican voters, and possibly a lot more than that, are happy to have Trump rerun against President Biden, despite all the criminal charges against Trump, the civil cases, and the disgusting, immoral, and dangerous behavior. So, John, I feel like you could argue this a couple of different ways. You could argue this is an incredibly strong showing by Trump, by far the largest victory in an Iowa caucus. Or maybe it's an okay showing, given that Iowa is rural and conservative and evangelical, and he still only got 50% of support, despite being a kind of incumbent. So which is it?
I don't think we know. We know a few things. He is king of the hill in Iowa. What we don't know is whether he's the king of a tiny hill. We don't know whether the hill is shrunk and small and older and whiter and less college educated and more male, which is all true of the entrance polls, what they told us, and that's the result of the fact that Trump has completely changed the party. But when I say party, what I mean is party activists who are willing to participate in a caucus. There's still been no answer about why, when caucus turnout was lower, whether it was because of the weather or whether it was lower and had that makeup that I just described, because that's what Donald Trump has turned the activist part of the party into. If, in fact, it's a result of the latter, and this is what Donald Trump's party looks like, then that is not good for him in a general election context. It means that a lot of Republicans, I mean, we should mention that only 15% of the registered Republicans in Iowa participated in the caucus. So there's no question he dominated the contest that took place. The larger question for all of us is, what does that contest tell us about anywhere else in the country? One thing that Iowa tells us that's different in the past for Republicans is that Iowa has often been the place where candidacies either go to die or go to get false hope. Candidates win Iowa and then lose elsewhere. I think this is probably closer to the case of Dole in 96 and Bush in 2000, where the winner of Iowa still looks like they're likely to go on to win the nomination, because the rest of the electorate, everything we know from polling and from interviews suggests that the electorate in Iowa, as small and Trump favored as it was, is in fact the electorate that's going to participate in the rest of the contest. So I think that's it's a little bit different in the past, but we won't really know until later. And one thing I'd like to see is in head-to-heads between Trump and Biden, and this will be my last point, is post-Iowa, post all of the notoriety that Trump gets and the decisive win he had in Iowa, whether his numbers in the head-to-head against Biden go down. In other words, a larger electorate, when reminded of the full Donald Trump, suddenly goes, and thinking of it as an actual comparison, starts to go, maybe not so good. We'll see.
From your mouth to God's ears. So, Emily, what's your sense about what it is that Iowa caucus goers found so appealing about Trump? I mean, just to lay my card on the table, my immigration card, it did seem, when I looked at all the quotes from caucus goers and sort of thematically word clouded it in my head, it felt like this increasingly agitated and angry rhetoric about immigration, about legitimate Americans, about the blood of the country is actually really quite closely aligned with what a lot of people, at least in Iowa, seem to be feeling. And it's an unhappiness stoked by conservative media for sure, but it's also one based on a sense that there really is a crisis on the border, and that somehow it's fundamentally threatening to people's sense of what America is.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like all those feelings, which Trump has been tapping into for years, the grievances, the sense of the country being taken away from people, the idea that he is the champion who's the truth teller in what's really affecting America and is going to make sure that these people's interests are taken into account in a way that other politicians aren't. And then I think there's just the fact that he's funny and entertaining, and some of the mockery of the other candidates just makes him stand out because it's still kind of wild and has a sort of, you know, late night TV feeling to it, that it just is zany and not boring and not canned.
One thing that interested me about the entrance polls, if we can believe them, and that's a big if, but is the two top qualities people picked for why they, or what they cared about in a candidate, was shares my values and fights for people like me. And Trump won overwhelmingly with those groups. What the fights for people like me seems to connect to is the fact that basically there are 99 counties in Iowa, and Trump used the courtroom as the 100th county. He basically campaigned in all of his various court appearances for the caucus electorate and / primary electorate with Republicans. And that syncs up, it seems to be. He's a fighter. He's not backing down in the face of these, you know, leftists who are coming after him in the courtroom. And that could link up with, he's always going to fight for me. The question, though, is when it gets to a general election, of course, is, okay, so the courtroom stuff might work for Republican diehards, this sliver of the party that showed up. But how's that going to work in the general election? And normally candidates move to the middle in the general election. Now, if the general election is all about just turning out your base, okay. But still, I think this goes back to the 15% in Iowa. What do the other members of the Republican Party in Iowa think about the rule of law? Implicit in the Trump, and we saw this in the entrance poll as well, when people said that they would still support him if he was convicted. Implicit in the Trump, support of the Trump candidacy is the court system and the rule of law across multiple jurisdictions is bankrupt, has no meaning. That's a pretty heavy thing to swallow, I would guess, for Republicans who have always considered themselves the party of law and order.
Do you guys think, John, digging in on that, but actually for both of you, so there was this number that said 30% of caucus goers. So these are the, again, as you say, the most hardcore activist part of the Republican Party in a very Republican state. 30% of them said a criminal conviction of Trump would make them reconsider voting for him, make them disqualify him as an election. Do you guys believe that number? Do you believe that actually there's a huge number of people who, if Trump were criminally convicted in one of the many, many cases he faces, that they would really then say, okay, I can't vote for him?
I kind of don't believe it, but of course it doesn't need to be anywhere near 30% to determine the course of the election. So in that sense, if it's just an indication that people are still paying attention, that there is something that even supporters of his would find disqualifying, maybe they would just stay home. I think that it's significant for that reason.
I think that people lie on that, or they don't lie, but people use that question as a kind of like, as a way to say, screw those who are trying to go after him in court. I'm going to vote for him anyway. So when it comes down to brass tacks, if he gets actually, you know, convicted, that's A, people may change their minds. B, as Emily just said, in a very, very Trumpy electorate, to even have 30 some odd percent not want to vote for him is bad news for him. And then again, we're still talking about a sliver of the Republican Party, all those people who stayed home. It's not inconceivable that some not trivial percentage of the people who stayed home are sick of Donald Trump and the convictions and all of that stuff. We don't know, but it's not crazy. And then that would, of course, have some, that would play some role in the general election, but only, as we should remember, if it plays a role in the eight battleground states that are likely to decide the general election.
John, you're framing this in some ways, I feel like. You're framing this as this, you know, this is, there are troubling signs for Trump in here. This caucus also seemed like the worst possible outcome for Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, that they both, like DeSantis got second, but it very weakly after so much investment. Haley, who wanted to show that she was in a two-person race with Trump, didn't manage to finish second, and so now has to sort of bet it all. She's all in on New Hampshire. And DeSantis is basically out of money, out of time, out of everything, out of support. He's wasted everything. And so yes, I understand that there are these warning signs for Trump. Maybe you're just saying for the general, but certainly like Haley and DeSantis are not going into New Hampshire being like, yes, what a great night.
Yes, the shortest, hottest take is great short term, maybe not so great long term for Trump. He, as I said earlier, he dominated. Think about how he dominated, and goes back to your point about him running as an incumbent. Sure, but remember after 2022, people are like, Donald Trump's a loser. The Republican Party's going to kick him to the curb. I mean, he's lost the popular vote twice. He lost in 2020. His candidates lost in 2022. He's toxic. They're getting away from him. That's the end of Donald Trump. So he came way back from that. And also think about what he has gotten. Previously kind of sterling public reputation Republicans to get behind in their endorsement of him. Not only everything he did in office, but now all the things that they know that he did that have come out as a result of people very close to him testifying under oath about his behavior in office. And knowing all of that, you have all of these people, who Mike Lee, Marco Rubio, who have staked their reputation on supporting him. That's a harder thing to do, knowing now what they know about Donald Trump, and yet they have done it with glee. And so as a political matter, he has dominated not only in the results, but in dominating people who might, you could imagine, do something else given, you know, the old fashioned rules of politics. So no, I don't, I'm absolutely saying this was a dominance within his own party, but I think that there are still big long-term questions and possible challenges that are inversely proportionate, or not that are still to come.
What did you guys make of this chart that Nate Cohn from the New York Times posted about the extraordinary educational divide for voters, where Haley was winning the parts of the state that have lots of people who went to college and then absolutely bombing in the less educated precincts? I guess, you know, if you think about this from Trump's point of view, it's what you'd expect. It made me wonder if it was another sign about the medium to long term, about possible problems he might have with part of the party. I mean, maybe these are the people who are more troubled by the kind of rule of law issues or have a different set of concerns that are not the kind of red meat of his base.
Didn't your New York Times also run a story this week, though, saying that Trump has a lot of college support?
Yes,
or
the day
before come back to love
that. Yes, I was wondering about the timing of that story as well.
The Haley voters in Iowa told the Des Moines Register, a lot of them, that they would either vote for Biden or stay home. And our reporting out of New Hampshire suggests the same thing, that the independents and crossover voters are either going to stay home or vote for Biden. Again, short-term good for Trump, long-term bad for Trump.
There was an interesting piece, I think it was a Ross Douthat piece, arguing like, you know, Republicans, anti-Trumpers, you really blew it. Like your one chance here was you should have found a way to get behind Ron DeSantis, made it all about DeSantis. And even though DeSantis comes with all these sort of Trumpy qualities, he's not Trump. He would have been a relatively normal, you know, right-wing, very conservative, anti-woke, but a kind of regular order politician. And you blew it by not focusing your attention. So, Emily, my question to you is, if Ron DeSantis had a chance to time machine all of this, and other Republicans did, and go back a year, but you have to assume that Ron DeSantis has the same dismal personality and horror movie smile that he possesses, that doesn't change. Was there a world in which he actually could have knocked Trump out?
I mean, didn't Ross suggest like, oh, run more on competence and just running the government and seeming more? I just felt like
John,
he kind of tried.
Dickerson face here.
I know, right? I just was sort of like, I don't see the play that he didn't run if he's still the same actual human being.
Also, it's so irritating when it's like, imagine another world, not the one that we've seen totally disproved again and again and again and again and again and again. And then this crazy thing will happen. It's so irritating. However, it does. I think what it does show us is how far the party has come from what would have been normally a great resume for DeSantis. And a state like Iowa should have been great for him. He'd had the ground game. He had the relationship with evangelical leaders and evangelicals. He's come from a hugely important state, not as important as it used to be because it's not as much of a battleground. But Florida is a big deal. To do well there and to have delivered there, that's the thing. It's not just that he says all the right stuff. He has accomplishments he can point to that they should like. I mean, the whole setup of DeSantis is not anything Ron DeSantis did wrong, although, again, he obviously has hurdles to overcome in terms of his retail politicking. But, you know, Steve Forbes was a force in the Republican Party once. There are people who are not great campaigners who have done well in the Republican Party in the past with far weaker resumes. And so I think it's so strange to put it all on DeSantis. He has weaknesses, but it's also a complete reversal of what would have been the normal role in politics. And a lot of that is because Donald Trump has an identity connection with the intense voters in his party who participated in the caucuses. And that identity connection means, as Donald Trump said, he could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and they would still support him.
Let's end this topic actually with a brief disquisition on the narrow Rube Goldberg-y path that Nikki Haley has. What is the world, Emily or John? In which Nikki Haley somehow keeps this as a race?
Well, I think it's hard to confect such a world because the worst thing that Nikki Haley could do in terms of Republican voters is beat Donald Trump. So, I mean, which is to say that the outcome she is striving for is inconsistent with the outcome she is striving for. The path would be this. Haley does well in New Hampshire, either gets super close or beats Donald Trump in New Hampshire. And in so doing, he does what he always has done, which is savage her. And in so doing, says something that even despite the fact that of all the things he said in all the worlds, and I'm not engaging the behavior I was just criticizing. Yes. I was asked a question by David.
Imagine
and
a
so
piano.
I am accepting your frame and imagining a can opener here. But that he does or says something that's so objectionable, not just on kind of moral and ethical and politesse grounds, but on electoral grounds. I mean, he's shredded his relationship with suburban women. But let's imagine he shreds it further, which leads everybody to a big conversation about electability. Haley does do better than Trump in head-to-heads with Biden. Maybe then that does something. But this is all fantasy, I think, really, what I just told you. And I think in addition to being fantasy on its face, it is more fantasy because Nikki Haley has decided, because of the very first thing I said, that attacking Donald Trump is inconsistent with her goals in the end. But if it's a two-person race, as she has tried to will it to be, then it is not crazy for her to make a comparison with Donald Trump. And she's not just a competitor with Donald Trump. She's a character witness. She saw him up close. And you could imagine in a race in the past, someone saying, you know, I saw him in the Oval Office when tough decisions came before him. And he is unfit. And I can say that because I've seen it up close. He is unfit to be president. I asked her twice on CBS Mornings if she would say that. She would not. She gave a lot of it. She said chaos follows him, as if chaos were something that he got stuck on his shoe in the men's room. And we know what Ambassador Haley looks like when she wants to go after an opponent, because we saw her do it with Ron DeSantis. And she was very effective and very you know, cutting, about his temperament, about his lying, about all kinds of things. And yet when it comes to Trump, you know, she has, to use a favorite cliche, an instinct for the capillaries. And so if it seems to me if she's not going to do that, nothing's going to change in the dynamic that has kept her far away from him in the polls and the results.
I want to give a thank you to our Slate Plus listeners. Because of you, we have been able to keep doing the Gabfest for so long. And Slate Plus listeners, of course, get great stuff, bonus segments, discounts to live shows, no hitting the paywall on the Slate site. And this week, you're going to get something really distinctive and special in your Slate Plus segment. Very narrow. We're going to talk about my father, because my father died this week, and he died at 86. And I think his life was wonderful. He was a wonderful father, which I'll talk about. But it also tells us something about the last three quarters of a century of American life. And it also tells you something about me. So if you want to know either about the last 75 years of American life or about me, please become a Slate Plus member. If you are a Slate Plus member already, thank you. If you're not a member, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Loper Bright v. Raimondo and its sister case, Relentless v. Department of Commerce, but we're going to talk about Loper Bright as though it's just Loper Bright, is shaping up to be perhaps the most consequential Supreme Court case of the term and could fundamentally change how federal government agencies work. It was argued at the court yesterday. There are indications that the conservative majority is tempted to chuck a 40-year-old rule about who gets to decide the nitty-gritty of government regulation and policies, whether it is the bureaucrats and experts who work for the federal government or whether it's judges interpreting what a congressional statute meant in order to decide that nitty-gritty. So really fascinating case, one that is the culmination of a generation of work by conservative legal activists who've been really, really wanting to undermine what they call the administrative state. And they got their wish. They have a 6-3 conservative majority, and they got to argue it yesterday. Lawyers who seem to be connected to the Coke industries were among those who were paid to argue this case. Emily, why don't you start us off by briefly explaining Loper Bright's issues and why it's so important to conservatives? What is it about this that is so important to conservatives?
Well, it's funny because the issues in Loper Bright sound kind of sweet and small and like local fishermen. And that's why it's such a perfect vehicle for this much larger agenda that's being smuggled in about completely potentially changing the authority that federal agencies have to interpret statutes. So the actual cute sounding facts are that the Secretary of Commerce and the National Marine Fisheries Service have the power under a particular law to implement a comprehensive fishery management program. And as part of that, the law says that they can require observers to go on board fishing vessels. The way that the federal agencies interpreted this was to issue a rule requiring the fishing industry to pay for the cost of having these observers. And it was like $700 and change a day. And so the fisher people did not want to pay for these observers, right? This is like government hanging over your head. Plus, the whole idea here is to make sure that we're not depleting the waters of the fishes. Fishes is not a word.
Depleting the fisheries, depleting the fishing stock, depleting the,
exactly.
the fish stock, the stock.
Depleting the fishing stock. And so, you know, there's that kind of bristling underneath this case too. Now, it should be said that this whole program doesn't exist anymore. It's defunct. And actually, the government reimbursed the costs of this $700 a day that people had incurred. So you could argue that the whole case is moot, but the law remains on the books and the Supreme Court merrily marches along. And here are some plaintiffs that the conservative legal activists can bring out saying, like, I don't want to pay for this. This is like government being intrusive in Big Brother. And meanwhile, what's really being challenged here is this rule called Chevron deference that has existed since 1984. And what happens with Chevron deference, it's a rule that comes from the Supreme Court, a decision written by Antonin Scalia low back in the day. And the idea is that if Congress writes a statute that is ambiguous, if it's not entirely clear how to implement it, then as long as the federal agency makes a reasonable interpretation of the statute, judges will defer to the agency's interpretation rather than coming in and rereading it themselves. So you have to have two things here. You have to have ambiguity and you have to have reasonableness in terms of the agency's reading. But the idea is that agencies are better situated than judges to make these kinds of calls because they're filled with hundreds of experts. This is their job.
And isn't it also that that agencies are better equipped than Congress to deal with some of these questions? So the judges can't say, well, Congress should be deciding this, not the agencies, because Congress moves too slowly.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a sort of other, you know, there's another way to think about this, which is that ideally Congress would write clearer statutes that you wouldn't, that like Congress would be the most democratic possibility, the actual elected officials sitting there and deciding how these observers are actually going to show up on the boats and do their job to make sure to protect our fishing stock. But Congress doesn't do that all the time. Sometimes ambiguity is crucial to getting a statute passed. Sometimes it's just a matter of the level of detail that legislators can actually take in. And I think one really important thing to remember is that if we end up without deference to agencies, we're going to end up with more deference to lobbyists. Because if there's pressure on Congress to write clearer laws, well, it's really the lobbyists who are going to be writing them because Congress is not staffed to do this kind of detailed work.
So the Supreme Court has already nibbled away at federal authority recently with this idea of the major questions doctrine, which is saying that when it comes to some big issue, a major question, it's not enough. The federal regulators can't just simply make a decision that's vast and intrusive based on their interpretation of a congressional law, because a major question really needs Congress to weigh in clearly. And so I would say, so major questions, now Supreme Court has said, no. And now it's like minor. Now it's this, I would call this the minor questions doctrine, which is that like, it's not just with the major questions. It's also with all the small things about like your herring boat captain paying a government observer. It's also there is no deference to a federal authority. So what is the strongest argument, Emily, that you heard for ditching Chevron deference? And also what's the strongest argument for keeping it?
I mean, I think the strongest argument for ditching it is that it means that judges and Congress are each not doing their job, that these unelected officials who work for federal agencies have way too much power. And, you know, when you look back at the original American constitutional system, we did not have giant federal agencies. They've become a kind of fourth branch of government. Now, I would say that's out of necessity because the country got much larger and the world got more complicated, but they're not originally there. And so if you're trying to go back to a kind of originalist understanding of separation of powers, then you want either Congress or the courts to be playing this role. I mean, to do the other side briefly, it's just not how the modern world has worked. There are more than 70 Supreme Court decisions that have relied on Chevron and countless lower court decisions. And when you think of the idea of what's really going to happen if they kill this kind of deference, you're going to have unelected judges making these calls, and they are less accountable to the people and the voters, right? Because at least the president runs the agencies. If you don't like how the president is telling the EPA to monitor power plants to reduce carbon emissions, well, you can get rid of that president. Whereas federal judges have lifetime tenure.
If this deference ends, will the practical reality of that be that judges actually start making these decisions, or that agencies had their, that there's a chilling effect and agencies just stop doing a lot of stuff because they think they'll get smacked back by judges? So which of those two is the greater practical?
Yes, exactly.
And which of the two of those is the greater practical reality? And then as a second question, does this mean, I have thought of it in the terms of the presidential campaign context, where the presidential candidates say, promise 18 billion things. None of them are going to happen through Congress because it moves too slowly, but some of them could happen, although not at the level at which all these promises are made, but some of it could happen through administrative actions. This would presumably weaken that ability to do things through administrative actions because these authorities are in general shrunk by the lack of this deference.
I mean, sure, in theory, but nobody's going to admit that, right? The candidates are going to say, we're going to write really clear laws.
Sure. Then they'd have to get those laws through Congress.
But also, I do think, John, that the agencies, when they have the will, can certainly still, they will still have the ability to say, here's how this is how we're interpreting this statute. And then it will be up to people to legally challenge it. But I think you're right that some agencies will be just like, we're not even going to bother because we know there's going to be so much litigation. Others will do it, and then there will be all this litigation. And actually, Emily, and to that end, I suspect there will also be forum shopping, which is that if you know that there's a Supreme Court that's pretty sympathetic, don't you? And all these regulations tend to affect the whole country. You find some case somewhere in the Fifth Circuit where you know it's going to get to probably a sympathetic conservative judge and then a sympathetic conservative appeals court, and you're golden.
Yeah, I mean, this is an anti-regulatory tool that will be on supercharge, especially, like you said, David, when you pair it with the major questions doctrine, you have the potential to really hamstring agencies. Now, you know, it is possible people have to write these laws to begin with. Writing legislation is really hard, right? Because you're trying to write words that account for all these different eventualities. And one of the things that Justice Kagan, who was clearly trying to defend Chevron deference, brought up was like, well, you know, as you try to make these laws clearer, is that really possible all the time in our modern world? Because you're having to account for, if the more specific you are, the more you end up leaving things out by accident. But it is possible that, you know, this will have a salutary effect on the drafting of the laws, that they will be more clear and there'll be less ambiguity for the federal agencies to navigate, and it'll all go wonderfully and not just turn into a way to have zero regulations.
Going back to your point, the lubricating benefit of lack of specificity is enormous. So getting things passed, the more specific you have to be in legislation, the more you open yourself up to attacks by someone somewhere and having your legislation get run away with by a misinterpretation of a line of specificity. It seems like it would be a big problem there. And just on the presidential campaign thing, of course, presidential candidates are going to keep promising the moon. But if this deference goes away, their promises were always bogus in a lot of ways, but now they'll be even more bogus because of the limitations.
Two notes about things that conservative justices said. One is Justice Kavanaugh made an interesting point, which is that administrations change, and therefore interpretation of what regulations mean change. And so it isn't the case that once a federal agency decides, oh, yes, you know, this means you can never throw mercury in the water, that's it. It's the next time you have a presidential election, or even if you don't even have to have a presidential election, the president could change their mind the next day, or a new administration come in and say, no, throw mercury in the water whenever you want. This is a great place for your mercury.
There is democratic accountability in federal agencies.
It's unpredictable. It's that one of the reasons you want to have agency interpretation. One of the claims for agency interpretation is, oh, it's consistent. It is like reliable. It is made by expertise, and that is reliable, and you can count on it. But he's saying no, it's subject to the whims of politics, and that is problematic too, because businesses can't decide how they're going to invest if they think I can put mercury here today but not tomorrow. They're going to be worried.
I mean, there is some of that, but in reality, most regulations stick because it's in fact incredibly time consuming to start all over again. I mean, lots, and because of the Administrative Procedural Act, which is the APA, the kind of giant foundational law for the way agencies work, most of what they do, if you want to do it again, first, to do it in the first place, you have to go through this cumbersome, long notice and comment period. And then to unwind it, you have to do the same thing. And so, you know, there are some exceptions to that, but they're relatively minor. And I'm sure that if you look at all the regulations that get issued, the idea that they're just like willy-nilly snapping back and forth is a very, very small percentage.
But I'm confused. Isn't the theory that basically if the judges say this isn't for the administrative state to do, that it's for Congress to do? So,
well, that's their isn't claim. That the practical, absolutely. Right? Yeah. Well, that's what they're claiming. But in reality, what's going to happen is Congress is still going to write ambiguous statutes, and then the judges are going to be wading in and saying, like, no, I think, right? So the issue is that the agencies will still issue the interpretation, but instead of a standard that says, like, okay, I'm not sure this is perfect, but it's fine, the judges will be like, no, 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 I read it differently.
Sure.
Much more
well,
often.
Well, no, they don't. I mean, will they say they read it differently or they read your authority to do it differently? I guess maybe that's the same thing. But I guess my point is, if you're looking for the locus of the personal failings of the legal profession, couldn't it also be in an excessive belief in the idea that Congress can write good laws and not just in their own brilliance and power to weigh all of these future decisions?
Well, I think it's both, John. I think it's this fantasia. There is this delusional fantasia like, oh, we're going to fix it. It's really up to Congress to do this, and Congress will do it.
Well,
that's fantastical.
Yes.
But then the result of that fantasy is that it leaves someone who has to make the decision. And it's like, well, it can't be these pointy-headed bureaucrats who all, you know, just want to kill all the people and have spotted owls rule us. It's got to be, instead, it has to be somebody else. And look, it's got to be, someone's got to interpret it. And it's much better that it be these judges, be us. But so it's a fantasy that leads to an accretion of power, is my view.
And also, like you said, if it's a conservative judiciary, then they're going to be more skeptical of regulation. And that is a big thing that corporate America wants from the courts and the political system right now.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
We are joined now by a GabFest favorite, the New York Times' David Leonhardt. David recently had a piece in the Times, The Misguided War on the SAT, that explores the sudden and surprising and comprehensive movement of colleges away from the SAT and the ACT. The overwhelming majority of American colleges, more than 1,900 of the 2,100 or so colleges in the country, are now test optional, meaning that applicants do not have to submit SAT or ACT scores in their application. Most schools were moving sort of away from this slowly pre-COVID, but COVID accelerated it, and because of in-person testing being verboten, and they have not gone back post-COVID. And they, for the most part, they show few signs of going back. The schools that have gone test optional claim, probably erroneously, as we will discuss, that the SAT and ACT hurt Black and Latino applicants who may score lower for reasons people infer as bias in the test. David's piece examines the evidence and the claims about it and says, wait a minute, have we made a mistake? So David, to start, do the SAT and ACT disproportionately hurt the chances of Black and Latino students from getting into selective colleges or not?
Well, that's a very complicated question to start with, David. You could do an easier
question if you wanted.
No, that's fair. No, they could, but I think they don't have to. So I think the thing, there are gaps by both economic class and race in average scores. Upper income students do better than lower income students. White and Asian students do better than Black and Latino students on average. And so if we went to a system that was based entirely on the SAT or ACT or overwhelmingly on it, I do think it would reduce diversity. The question is, can you still have diversity? And can you also admit better prepared classes if you use the SAT and ACT as one factor? And that is where the real argument is.
So it seems like one way to think about this is that colleges need a way to differentiate among students. And ideally, they would pick a method that provides them with the students who are most likely to take advantage of college and do well, as opposed to struggle and drop out or just do poorly. And I think part of your argument is the SAT is useful for that outcome, right? And you can think of it in your telling as a kind of least of all evils as well, right? That there are colleges have to differentiate in some way. There is no such thing as total fairness. And so one of the things I think you're talking about is how if schools don't have the SAT, then there's more pressure on grades in terms of decision making, which can be really affected by grade inflation increasingly, but also more pressure on things like recommendations and essays and what you call polish, these things that basically wealthy families can also pay for. So is that part of the argument here?
Yes. So I think a lot of people hate standardized tests, in part because they're unpleasant. I didn't enjoy taking them. And in part because I think they've become, they have a really bad reputation on the political left in our country. And who controls college campuses? The political left. And so I think what a lot of people who want to move away from the SAT have said, wait a second, why can't we just use student essays where people can express themselves and extracurriculars where they can show us their breadth and grades? Isn't that enough? But that's a really problematic mix for two main reasons. One, all those things, Emily, you just used the word polish, that we think of as showing us the whole child, are incredibly biased toward affluent people. Highly educated people, maybe even some GabFest listeners, spend a lot of time editing the college essays that their children write. If students who go to private schools have guidance counselors who spend hours on their recommendations for college. At public schools, guidance counselors have hundreds of students. They often ask students to write their own recommendations. Who can afford to do music lessons and overseas trips and travel sports? So those soft factors are incredibly biased toward affluent people. Grades are less biased, but grades are problematic in another way. Thanks in part to grade inflation, there are just too many kids getting almost all A's or even all A's now for colleges to make decisions based on grade inflation. That's what the head of admissions at MIT, which is one of the schools along with Georgetown and a handful of other schools that have gone back to the SAT, said, we can't make decisions based on grades. So in a world in which you're ignoring standardized tests, and I can come in a minute to the case for the tests, but in a world in which you're ignoring standardized tests, you've got two sets of factors, one of which is really biased toward affluent people, and the other of which is super noisy. And when these schools are admitting disadvantaged kids based on grades, they basically have to guess. They're like, oh, look at these 20 kids from disadvantaged places with almost all A's. We want to admit four of them. We're going to guess which four are going to do better.
Why is this important? Why is it important that this test is good or bad at whatever it may or be good or bad at?
So for most colleges in America, they don't need the SAT and ACT. Grades are enough because they're not trying to make these fine-grained distinctions of who are the top 5% or the top 1% of students. So in terms of the big questions of getting more Americans college degrees, this is a bit of a sideshow. But I still think it matters. And I think it matters both because Americans care about who's going to the University of California at Berkeley and who's going to the University of Michigan and who's going to Harvard. And so if people care, we should care about what process we have for choosing who gets to take advantage of these scarce resources. And at the very, very elites, it's clear that they disproportionately produce our CEOs and even more so our senators and our Supreme Court justices. And these are the colleges with the best resources. So from a societal perspective, if we want to cure diseases that are killing people, if we want to have breakthroughs in clean energy, we want to funnel the very best students to the labs that have the most resources. And I think that is why we should care about who goes to these schools and not simply think of it, let's just make it a lottery. That'll be fine. That's a reasonable view, right? Like, let's just, Harvard has huge resources. Some people make this argument. Let's just kind of make it a lottery for good students. But there really is a counter argument that we should care about who's getting these opportunities.
So, David, one thing I wondered about, which I think I have figured out the syllogism in my own head, but I would rather you do it, which is schools, except for a few places like the University of California system, haven't barred students from doing the test. They've just made it test optional. So what's wrong with a world in which people who want to show off with a test can show off with a test and people who don't, don't? Like, why isn't that just the better solution? Like, oh yeah, if you want to prove that you're a good test taker, and great, here, go ahead and do it.
So that's right. Most places have gone test optional. But when you go test optional and you send this signal that you don't actually need to do it, I think what tends to happen is kids from more privileged backgrounds still take the test almost no matter what. And they submit it only if it's good for them. So weirdly, that's another way in which a test optional system privileges the advantaged. And then lots of kids from less advantaged backgrounds actually will decide not to take the test. And so we then are into this situation in which the colleges are guessing. Or maybe they'll take the test and they'll make a bad strategic decision. And they'll think, oh my goodness, I got a score. I got only, and I'm making up numbers here, a 1400, which is at the 25th percentile of the admitted students. I'm not going to submit it. Actually, if you come from a disadvantaged background and you have all A's and you get a score at the 25th percentile of one of these really selective colleges, that's great. There's a really good chance they're going to admit you. They're worried that actually you got a score at the third percentile. Right. And so in a test optional system, there really are fewer kids taking the test. And by the way, California is a big state. And I think one of the things that's particularly happened in California is that because their system has gone test blind, they have said, we will not accept your score even if you take it. Many, many students in California don't take the test. And it's become particularly hard for admissions officers outside of California to make decisions about kids who are coming from California when they're not coming from a fancy private school or from a magnet public school that the admissions officers understand exactly what it means that they took chemistry in this grade.
Right. I mean, the kids who benefit from these tests are the kids who come from high schools that the admissions officers have never heard of because they've never, very rarely, sent students to the top universities. And so then it's harder for the admissions officers to judge what these top grades mean compared with all these other kids, right?
Yeah. Look, the way I would think of it is the strongest argument for doing it is, and I haven't even said this yet, this is really important. The SAT, some people have heard over the years that high school grades predict college performance better than standardized tests. The data used to be mixed on this. It's always shown that grades plus SATs are better than only one, which you could say in and of itself, that's an argument for keeping the test. But now the data is very clear that tests do a better job of predicting how students will do in college than grades, partly because of grade inflation. And so the argument for keeping them is, look, we have this tool that tells us who does well. It's not just that rich kids do better than poor kids. There's huge variation within rich and poor kids. This can help us tell us which lower income kids should be admitted. And we're deliberately ignoring it. We would never deliver, if there were a three-hour test that told us who was really good at layups in basketball, I promise you, no college basketball coaches would say, oh, we're not going to look at that test.
What I love is the quote you have from the University of California system, which said basically, in not answering your inquiries, said that they're committed to combating systemic inequities. And your point is, yes, and if that were true, you'd be using the standardized test, that it's the tool to achieve the goal that they say that they're committed to and therefore not using the test. Can I slide in, if you agree with that, awesome. But also let me just attach a question, which is what attributes do these tests actually discover? In other words, why are they a better measurement? Do we know what it is about what they measure? Even if it's imperfect, it's still better than grades? Or is it just that grades are bad because of grade inflation?
they measure logical reasoning. They measure quantitative reasoning. They basically measure things that correlate quite closely to, are you going to be able to be a good lawyer or be a good scientific researcher or be a good historian? Or, and by no means is, we should not be admitting kids just based on that. We should also care about leadership. We should, you know, we should care about all kinds of things. The question is it one of the things that we should care about?
One incentive that schools have to drop the SAT right now is the end of affirmative action. Because if you look at the lawsuits that succeeded against Harvard and the University of North Carolina, the divergence, the differences in SAT scores was one of the key reasons that the plaintiffs were able to argue that they were not having colorblind admissions, right? Because they could show this discrepancy in the scores based on racial group. I feel like that's a kind of smuggled in part of the agenda of the schools right now, is to try to protect themselves from being the next school that gets sued. And I wonder how that fits into this question of the, you know, likely continuation of the SAT and the ACT.
That's a really important point, Emily. They are worried about this Supreme Court decision. And I don't mean to suggest that this is an easy decision for colleges. Here's how I would think about it. There is a real cost in going test optional. You lose some academic excellence, and it is harder particularly to identify the truly academically excellent kids who come from less privileged backgrounds. I think that's a real cost. But there are also risks in going back to a test requirement. One of the risks is once you have this number, it's really hard for people not to pay too much attention to a number, right? And so you could imagine a world in which once they start requiring it again, they do become more upper income or more heavily white and Asian because they focus so much on the number. And then another risk is the one that you said, which is the legal risk. And so the people I talk to who have gone back to requiring the SAT, like MIT, like Georgetown, like Purdue, like the state universities in some less liberal states like Florida and Georgia, they think there really is a way to do this and build diverse classes and do it legally. But it's hard, right? It means you have to say, hey, we're taking this kid who got a 1400 over this kid who got a 1500, because the kid who got a 1400 grew up in a neighborhood with much higher poverty, because they were running into the wind. And so actually their 1400 is more impressive than the other kid's 1500. And so I really do think there are a set of ways to do it that are both kind of justifiable in a philosophical sense and also well within the bounds of the law. The key point I would leave you with here is, if you're really worried about racial diversity backsliding at top American colleges in the wake of this decision, I understand that worry. Remember this. We live in a society with enormous racial inequities. And so if colleges can do things like take into account the neighborhood you grew up in, not just your family income, but your family wealth, the percentage of kids at your school who are at free and reduced lunch, horrifically, we live in a society where there are enormous gaps on those exact factors by race. But that also means it should be possible to design a college admissions process in which by taking into account economic factors and entrenched poverty and wealth, you are nonetheless building a racially diverse class. You're kind of solving for racism on both sides of the equation. And that is undeniably legal as long as you're not explicitly taking into account race.
David Leonhardt, his new piece is not so new at this moment. The Misguided War on the SAT. His great piece is The Misguided War on the SAT in the New York Times. Thanks, David.
Thanks, everyone.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you, Emily Bazelon, it's like 6 in the morning where you are, maybe not even 6 where you are. So that means you're probably like 2 drinks in. What are you going to be chattering about over breakfast with your morning cocktail?
I am excited for breakfast. I don't know if I can hack the morning cocktail today. My chatter is about a new podcast. It's from The Ringer. It's called Stick the Landing. The host is Andy Greenwald, and it's about how prestige TV, how dramatic series on TV, how well they stick the landing, how good their finales are. And they, in a genius move to win me over, chose Friday Night Lights as their first episode. And I am so happy to listen to endless discussion of Friday Night Lights, how it developed as a show, how it fits into the American pantheon of television, why it did or didn't, but mostly did stick the landing. I really enjoyed listening to this. So yeah, I recommend it. It is so low stakes and passionate at the same time, which is a great combination right now.
Cannot wait.
That is a great combination.
And one thing I learned from the episode of the show is that Friday Night Lights had two versions. There was an NBC version and a DirecTV version, and they were cut differently. And the current streaming version has like 44-minute episodes for a bunch of seasons, in which there are also like hour-long episodes. So they're just missing key scenes, including, it sounds like, the version of the finale that you can stream. So I actually rewatched the show recently, and my husband and I started wondering if we had the old DVDs we could dig out to try to watch the longer versions of the episodes.
That is revelatory. John, what is your chatter?
How much of the world's production do you think, manufactured goods in the world, how much of it do you think is produced by China?
Manufactured goods?
Yeah.
34%.
Very good, David. 31%. That seemed higher even than I thought. But anyway, so that's just a fact that intrigued me the other day when I was reading. But the actual chatter is I become a reader of Moss and Fog. The website mossandfog.com. It's beauty, design, and visual inspiration every day. And one of the recent, just super blood pressure lowering content is what this is. And recently there was an article on something called, and I thought of you, David, the website tree.fm. And essentially, right at the moment, I'm listening to a forest in Transylvania. And it basically provides you audio from forests all over the world. So, David, given your love of trees, let's see, if I click the next forest, it will take me to, Ibiza. So I'm getting a forest in Ibiza. Anyway, so...
There's probably a DJ set happening there.
So...
it's probably like a 4 a.m.
sprig in Ibiza. And this one is now somewhere in Russia. So it's very peaceful. And if you need background music to work, as I do, this is good stuff for that. But also Moss and Fog, which is very cool stuff.
I've already on that website. That is very exciting. My chatter is going to be the GabFest listeners, you're going to get a lot of sort of personal plots here in the coming minutes, those of you who are Slate Plus members. So because my chatter is also very personal. So as I mentioned up top, our Slate Plus segment is going to be about my father, who died this weekend at age 86. And Paul Plotz died of Alzheimer's disease. And he spent the last 2 years in a care facility called Arden Courts of Silver Spring near my parents' home in D.C. I'm not going to talk about him now. I'm going to save that for the Slate Plus segment. But what I have actually been talking to my friends about this week as at Shiva's and just around is two things related to Pa and his final years. First, during his last years, he was cared for by a bunch of people at Arden Courts, some nurses, mostly caregivers who have limited education and training, other support staff, cleaners and porters. And to a person, they were kind and helpful and selfless in their care. And it just makes me think, what made me think overwhelmingly, whenever I was with Pa and seeing how, you know, lovingly he was being treated, that it is just a crime and really one of the real injustices of our society, that we have an army of caregivers in this country. And in the case of our family, these caregivers were overwhelmingly immigrant women from Africa and Central America and a few men who are providing the most important and gentle and kind care to people like my father, people who are sick, confused, dying, and they're being paid like $20 or $25 an hour. And, you know, at best. And it's just insane that we have a health system where all the wrong things are insanely expensive and insurance is selling out gobs for them and then people are selling out gobs for them. But all the right things, which is like day-to-day kindness and feeding and dressing and attention, is compensated with peanuts. And if there were any true justice in the world, the workers of Arden Courts and other care workers would make two or three or five times what they're making. And a lot of us would make a lot less. So that's the first point. And the second point, which is also derived, which is just some like advice that I've learned just from good experience, actually, which I just want to pass on because I've talked about my father and his Alzheimer's repeatedly on the GabFest and did a conundrum about it and so forth. But I want to just give advice to anyone who has to look for care for a relative who's having a hard time. Because I spent a ton of time investigating memory care and other assisted living places around DC. My brother and my mother and I did that. And we ended up choosing Arden Courts of Silver Spring over places that were a lot more expensive and had a lot nicer furniture and had bigger rooms. And we did it for a very specific reason, which is that it felt like a warm, kind place where the residents seemed happy and where they were interacting with each other and with the staff. And that turned out to be amazing for us. I mean, it didn't change the fact that my father declined. It didn't change the fact that he died, but it changed the fact that we knew that when he woke up, he was greeted with a smile, that he was treated with respect and kindness and good humor by everyone who cared for him. And so if you were faced this choice, and I hope you don't ever, but if you do, I just really want you to think about not just the things that are obvious that the facilities put down about the size of their room or about, you know, the hours of nursing care available, but things about the warmth and kindness of a place. Because for us, that ended up being overwhelmingly what mattered, not any of the things that were on paper.
Amen. My parents had similar experiences, but the one I'm dealing with most recently is with my father-in-law, who's at a place, the nursing center at Little Creek in Knoxville. And what you described, David, there is a lot of that there, and that is to witness it also is to see the most beautiful acts of grace repeatedly in the tiniest little moments of life. It just makes you weep to see how beautiful these caregivers are. And I'm glad you, as hard as it was, you know, it certainly makes me better every time I see them. And I'm sure it had the same effect on you.
Listeners, you send us chatters this week. We need more of them. Come on, listeners. It's a new year. There are new things to talk about. Not all mopey like me. Come on. Send us great chatters. Email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. We need to hear them. We need something to buck us up. And we have a listener chatter this week from Kevin Collins.
Hi, GabFest. My name is Kevin Collins from San Antonio, Texas. My chatter is a tweet from @historyandmemes showing a video of a Station 2 TV news broadcast in Iowa when they switched from black and white to color live on air for the first time on April 14, 1967. Despite color TVs being made available starting in 1954, it wasn't until the late 60s that most TV stations had moved to color programming, and not until the early 1970s that color TVs in North America outsold black and white ones. While there are no doubt many organizations who experienced this change firsthand, it's remarkable to see it happen and to see what television looked like before and never to be the same again.
That is our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugan. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio for Slate. Did you guys see that Slate just bought Death, Sex, and Money, the great podcast? And that means Death, Sex, and Money will now be our sister podcast, which is great. That's an amazing podcast. Anna Sale is a genius. So excited about that. We should cross over Death, Sex, and Money and GabFest. Death, Sex, and GabFest. Politics, Sex, and Money. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We will talk to you next week. Hi, Slate Plus. How are you? It's going to be a weird Slate Plus segment because it's very personal and self-indulgent. But look, that's what you paid for. When you came here, that's what you paid for. So I just want to talk a little bit about my father who died on Saturday morning, Paul Plotz, and just talk about him just in particular ways, but also because of what I think his life shows about the changing nature of America in kind of a sad way, honestly. But you guys should interrupt whenever, wherever you know, ask questions, but I'm going to just start talking and then just interrupt me. So Paul Plotz grew up in Brooklyn. He was born in 1937, child of a doctor, Milton Plotz, who had a practice that he ran out of my father's house. My father grew up a very happy childhood. His mother was at home. She later was a poetry anthologist, Helen Ratnoff Plotz. And he had a really happy childhood. And he went to friend school in Brooklyn. And then he if you're born in 1937 in Brooklyn and you grow up, you know, half a mile from Ebbets Field, you grow up to be an insanely devoted Brooklyn Dodgers fan. And so even very late in his Alzheimer's, I would just mention Jackie Robinson or Duke Snider or Pee Wee Reese to him, and his face would light up. So he would go to Ebbets Field all the time and saw Jackie Robinson steal home. And, you know, he lived and died for the Dodgers, but mostly he was just like a lovely, smart kid who ended up becoming a doctor. And this is where I think he comes from this generation, which, Emily, I think your parents come from. John, I think your parents didn't. Your parents are sort of an older generation. But he comes from this extremely lucky generation, which is born. It's like a mysterious generation and kind of a lost generation. It's the Biden generation. It's born too young to fight in World War II or Korea, too young to feel the depression. I mean, because their parents, both my parents' parents felt the depression, but as kids, they didn't really feel it. But also too old for Vietnam and too old for the 60s. And it's a very placid and peaceful childhood, young adulthood, leading to and coming of age in an America that was insanely prosperous and where there's opportunity everywhere and where there's also this sense of, you know, there's a cause of the nation. I mean, I'm talking about for white people, by the way, like for white people with from education. And it's just so lucky. So my mother ended up getting, you know, it was a time when they were handing out tenure track jobs in the humanities, the way Google now hands out jobs to AI engineers. Like you could get a job my mother's brilliant and could have gotten a job in any era, but like as an English professor, like no problem. Like anyone, there are English professor jobs aplenty. And then my father was a doctor and made this decision really early on to do medical research and be a physician, became a rheumatologist treating diseases of muscles and joints, but to kind of go into government research. And he went to the NIH as a very young man in the early mid 60s. And at the NIH, he, you know, foregoed a lot of things. He foregoed high salary. He foregoed, you know, prestige in some ways. But what he got was this chance to contribute to this massive government project of research and to spend an entire career studying diseases and caring for patients and doing important research without having to be tied. That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.